I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the 200th anniversary of the publication of the book Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus. Indiana Humanities is leading an effort to explore the story's dimensions and understand why it still resonates today. My guests are Megan Teligman, Indiana Humanities Frankenstein Program Manager, author Victor Laval, and Susan Davis from the Indianapolis Public Library. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today, this is going to be a fun one, we're going to be talking about some efforts Indiana Humanities has to explore the themes of the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. That is somewhat distinctive from many of the film adaptations of it, and we're gonna dive into what some of those differences are. This is the 200th anniversary. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the publication of the book. Actually, we're, what, about 10 months late, right? Because it was January 1, 1818. My guests are Megan Teligman, Indiana Humanities Frankenstein Program Manager, Victor Laval, who is an author, most recently, of a graphic novel that sort of updates and goes deeper into the whole Frankenstein story and explores those themes. We're going to talk about that. And Susan Davis from the Indianapolis Public Library. If you want to join the conversation, I should say welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I'll tell you what, let's start first, because I think once we start talking about the book itself, we're going to disappear into that. we may not make our way back out, because it is fascinating. I haven't read it in more than 30 years, but it is fascinating. Megan, I'm going to ask you to start talking about really some of the events that are associated with this effort.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks again for having us. So as you noted, it's the 200th anniversary of the book, so I would say it's the perfect year, maybe, to pick it up and read it again. But we are celebrating this anniversary by organizing activities across the state as part of a statewide read we're calling One State, One Story Frankenstein. So this is a series of programs and grants throughout Indianapolis and, like I said, from Lake Michigan all the way down to, we have grantees in the southern parts of the state as well. So we received a monstrous grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to pull off all these programs and grants. And we joke around the office that the programming has become truly monstrous because to date we have more than 600 programs that are happening throughout the state, 200 in the month of October alone, including some great programming at the Indianapolis Public Library that Susan can talk about. But yeah, it's been just a phenomenal way to catalyze conversations about science, technology, the limits of those things, and some really interesting ethical questions that Mary Shelley brought up 200 years ago.
And Susan, I think that was your cue here.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, sure. At the Indianapolis Public Library, we're very excited to be partnering with Indiana Humanities for a variety of programming. We are hosting book discussions throughout our branches, as well as some lectures about different themes that are found in Frankenstein. We also will be hosting a wonderful talk with Rebecca Skloot and two members of the Lax family. That'll be October 24th. We're really excited about talking about the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. that on that date. So it should be a great talk. And then we also will be doing a Frankenstein play. Ball State created an original play, and we are serving up beers at our Frankenstein's Beer Garden along with the play on October 19th. So all sorts of fun things and some wonderful talks. We're going to delve into themes found throughout the entire book of Frankenstein.
What's interesting about that is when you make reference to the play, my understanding of this is that what really kind of propelled the book forward, too, was that there was a play adaptation back in the early 19th century that drew attention back to the original source material. And, of course, now more people probably know it through movies than the actual book. And that creates some problems along the way, too, because they're misapprehensions. So, Victor, I should say, before we get started, I really enjoyed Destroyer, graphic novel, and found it incredibly creative and provocative. I want to ask what drew you, because I'm not sure, and I'm going to try not to give too much of it away. Right. Because I want people to read it, as I assume you do.
I appreciate
too.
That. Yes, yeah. I do too. Yes.
So, but not only do you deal with this, pull in some themes about, the dangers of too great a reliance on technology, ecology, basically. There's some environmental themes in there.
For sure.
But you also tie in the concerns we have these days with Black Lives Matter and the whole idea of what is the worth of a human being.
Yes.
So and I should say, in reading this thing, everyone's going to be aware how much you care about those issues. What I'm really curious about, though, is how did you decide on Frankenstein as the vehicle to explore those themes?
Well, I'd reread the novel, I want to say it was 2014 or so, because I was teaching it for a class that I teach on first novels. And people often don't realize, of course, that it was Mary Shelley's first novel. But when I reread it, it was a reminder to me of how political that novel was and how many different things she was tackling and how sort of complicated a set of concerns she brought to the page, even to the idea that the creature in the original book, the monster, whatever you want to call him, is a vegan, and he only eats leaves and berries. And certainly by the time we get to Boris Karloff and all the other versions, veganism is not at the top of the list of what people remember about Frankenstein, But she put it in there because her mother was, Mary Wollstonecraft was a famous, among other things, vegan. And so she wanted to put in there this idea that this new human might have to eat in new ways. Now, whether or not a 7-foot human could live on berries and little leaves is another issue. Mm-hmm. But when I saw how a book could be about this great big sort of horror-y or science fiction-y idea, but also wrestle with the political concerns of that author in the moment, I thought this is a story I could dive back into.
How did you get to the idea of connecting it to Black Lives Matter?
Well, for me, the big thing was at the end of the novel, Shelley's novel, the creature isn't dead. It says it's going to go off and kill itself now that Victor Frankenstein has died, but it hasn't died. And then there's one member of that Frankenstein family, Edward Frankenstein, is the only one who survives the monster's wrath. And so I sort of put together, I knew I wasn't going to go back and just retell the story of Frankenstein again, because that's been done a lot. And it wasn't the way I thought I could imagine myself going in. But then I started thinking, well, what if Edward, maybe he would leave Europe because, they've had a pretty bad time in Europe, the Frankenstein family. So maybe he comes to the U.S. And I just started extrapolating down to, if he comes to the U.S. and he moves here, how many generations would it take before, he's marrying or somebody's marrying a Black family member, and then all of a sudden this becomes a story about a Black American woman who is the brilliant scientist. And I, in a sort of dreamlike logic, I started saying I could see how this could come toward a story about a kind of person I know. And that would allow me then to inject those politics the same way Mary Shelley did, because those were the ones that concerned me.
If you're just joining us, We're talking about the book Frankenstein and its lingering impact on our culture. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Helen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Helen, you're on the air.
I'm a student at Brebeuf Jesuit Preparatory High School, and I was listening to your show on break, and I heard that it was the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein, which is really interesting because Brebeuf Jesuit is performing our fall play, which is Frankenstein, this weekend on Friday and Saturday. And it was just really interesting, and I wanted to share the news because it supports our arts program.
Oh, well, thanks for calling, and don't stay out on break too long, okay? We don't want to get in trouble with you teachers. Megan made a note of this. Thanks very much for the call, Helen.
Thank you.
So, obviously, that illustrates the fact that it's got an ongoing relevance, which is what allows us, I think, to start diving into the larger subject here. Why does it still speak to us with the kind of power that it does? I'll start with Susan on that one, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of themes in Frankenstein that still are applicable to today. Definitely when you're looking at the aspect about even scientific discovery and what are our responsibilities and consequences of scientific discovery, that it still applies to a lot of the greater things that are happening. Think about like AI or IA, and then AI, sorry. And then, you know, even all sorts of different things with bioethics and medical experiments and everything that can kind of tie into that aspect of what our responsibilities when we move forward with discovering different aspects of science. And
Megan.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's the most useful parallel in a lot of the conversations I've seen happening this year is about, like, technologies are proliferating. We're seeing, like, them find their way into our lives in more insidious and obvious ways. Mm-hmm. And so with that kind of proliferation and as we start to incorporate these technologies and not just the technology we use but within our own bodies, right? I'm thinking about the nanobots that are present in Victor's adaptation. As we continue to bring those technologies into our bodies, what kind of questions does that raise about what it means to be human? Like, how far is too far? Do we lose some of our humanity in the kind of bringing in of all that technology? But there's a lot packed into that book. And I think one thing that's really resonated for me is if you go back and read the book, you find that it's very different than some of the film adaptations. Right. And one of the major themes is, like, how do you relate to someone who is so visibly different than yourself, right? Mm-hmm. The creature is turned away and beaten and just rejected by society based on how he looks. Mm-hmm. And so kind of thinking about how do we deal with empathy? How do we think about relating to someone who isn't like us, I think is obviously very resonant today.
Mm-hmm. Victor.
And for me, I think another aspect that is deeply embedded in the book is if you know that Mary Shelley had her mother die in childbirth, giving birth to her, and that she then found her own child dead in the crib just months before she writes the first draft of Frankenstein, you can understand how there is at the heart of this also this depth of pain and grief, and that the idea that one would do anything to cross the boundary of death to bring someone back who you loved, or just to bring anything back and embrace it
again. Which is the Prometheus reference, too.
Exactly.
Is the stealing fire from the gods.
That's right. And I think that that's such a primal and inherently human desire. And it's Mary Shelley sort of found a way to put it on every page of that book so that when you read it, you feel her grief, her desire, her loss through Victor, through the creature, and it has a profound effect.
Yeah, and your retelling or updating of it, one of the things I loved was the sly way you introduce names from the novel in there.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the kind of ineffectual agents.
Yes.
Percy and Byron, I thought, were fascinating, but even making reference to characters that were in the original novel themselves. Was that difficult to do, to squeeze, to pack that much of the book in there?
Oh, no, that was part of the fun. You know, that was the old Easter eggs idea, and thinking for anyone who knows the original, these will be enjoyable. And for anyone else, you just enjoy
it. It's not a distraction. Yeah, it's not there. It's not to the point where there's neon signs flashing saying I'm making reference to the original text here. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana Humanities effort to explore the themes in the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. It's the 200th anniversary of the publication of the book this year. My guests are Megan Teligman, Indiana Humanities Frankenstein Program Manager, author Victor Laval, and Susan Davis from the Indianapolis Public Library. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Indiana Humanities campaign of sorts to explore the story and the themes within the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, which is celebrating its 200th anniversary this year. My guests are Megan Teligman. She is the Indiana Humanities Frankenstein Program Manager, author Victor Laval, and Susan Davis from the Indianapolis Public Library. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or you can do what a listener did and reach out to us via Twitter and find us at WFYI. This listener writes, what impact did Mary's relationship with Shelley have on her writing? I'll throw that one. Everyone's looking in your direction, Victor, so I guess okay. You get that one first.
Well, one really interesting impact was that he was her editor for the original. And different people feel different ways about this, but I would say, and he made it worse as a result. Or he made it more Shelley-ish, mm-hmm. right? In that her version of the book, her writing was clear and direct. She was really mm-hmm. a really nice, clear, direct writer who had great sympathy for the creation, for the monster. And then Shelley edited it and gave it a little bit more of the flowery, poetic language that we think of as his. But he had much more empathy for Victor Frankenstein. And so he wanted his pass to show that Victor Frankenstein was a great man who should be respected because he had done something so amazing, like bringing life back. And hey, if he wasn't the best father, what are you going to do about it? You know, like that's kind of his mm-hmm. take on it. And if you ever read the Norton editions, they have like mm-hmm. both versions. And it's kind of interesting to read to see how little editing needed to happen to make it seem like either a book that by the end you feel sympathy for the monster or at the end you feel sympathy for Victor. It doesn't take much to sort of tilt you one way or the other. And Shelley definitely went for for Victor, and I don't think that's the version that's lasted.
And I would be remiss, by the way, if I did not point out that Frankenstein, the novel, is part of the Great American Read, mm-hmm. And that you still have time to vote for it or any other book on the list if you so choose. So this raises a question, and it's one of the age-old ones. Who ultimately is the monster in the novel? Is it Victor or is it the creature? Susan, you made a mistake. You made eye contact. So I'm going with you first. All right.
Again, I kind of go back to that idea of when you're dabbling in this idea of creation and making things and discovery, what is your responsibility towards what you're creating and things about consent and what makes, you know, if you're bringing into this idea of what makes humanity move forward in these, you know, these discoveries. What kind of monstrous role did Victor play in not really taking into consideration what he was creating and what was his responsibility after creating this, you know, this whole another person? And that is, you know, interesting to think about what is his role in thinking through what are the next steps? Where is this going to lead? What do you have to, what are your then responsibility as, a, you know, the creator moving forward? Mm-hmm. And that kind of creates him a little bit more of a monster, not really thinking through these consequences.
Megan.
Yeah, I come down pretty firmly. I mean, this is the question of the book, right? So I think you can make pretty strong cases on either side. And actually, this is a cool story. There was a school that we gave a grant to that actually had this debate. Their debate team, like, took sides and had this argument. And there's compelling issues on both sides, right? The creature is clearly murderous, and so you have to grapple with that.
Although generally murderous only after some provocation.
Yes, which is, and so there's the complicating factor, right? But I come, personally, I come down pretty firmly on the idea of Victor being the monster. I mean, I've had a lot, like I said, I've had a lot of conversations about the book this year, and he is just a, he's very whiny, you know? Like, he is incapable or unwilling to take responsibility for his actions, as Susan said, and just the kind of neglect is, it's really hard to make a case for him as not monstrous in some way.
Victor.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that, and I also like that there's a case to be made. I think it was, again, an essay in that Norton anthology version, that the way Victor is written as that sort of whiny, self-involved, much too romantically in love with himself and his ideas, version is, was her way of also sticking it a little bit to Percy and to Byron.
Yeah.
You know, and saying, like, you don't see yourselves this way, but this is who you are.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that idea that she snuck that in and that it lasted, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not completely unfounded criticism.
No, I don't think so. Yes.
Either. So, you know, this actually is, I know it's considered a novel of many firsts. Some people argue that it's the, you know, the first science fiction novel, all of, in many other ways. But it's also a pretty serious piece. And yet it often is not perceived that way, largely because of the movies. So, Victor, I'm going to start with you. What has, what impact have all of the film adaptations had on the reputation of the novel and the way it is perceived, the cultural filter we run it, we end up running it through?
Well, certainly I think the biggest change or factor had to be, I mean, going back all the way to Bela Lugosi, right, and his desire or his decision when he was thinking of how to play the monster. He said famously he thought of him as a six-year-old, because Lugosi had an accent, so when they were thinking about the movie, the original movie, he couldn't say all the things that the monster says in the novel. He's a really talkative monster in the novel. There was no way Bela Lugosi was going to, one, be able to memorize all that, two, be able to sell it, you know. And so they decided instead he's mute. And then he said, I'll play him like a six-year-old. And in that way that he, even though he's gigantic and powerful, he's a child. And I think that really stuck in the idea that people have about him largely ever since. I mean, we have two kids, and one of their favorite animated movies a couple years ago was Alvin and the Chipmunks Meet Frankenstein. And it's all about how Frankenstein becomes buddies with Alvin and his chipmunk brothers. And that's very different from the original source material.
Megan, what have the movies done to it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely flattened the depth of the character, the creature that Shelley originally imagined him. And I think, too, one of the comments I hear all the time is just, I can't believe that, like, the whole middle of the book is just the creature talking. And his kind of story of coming into consciousness and the continual rejection, and, you know, those are some of my favorite parts to reread again and again this year, because he's just, you know, where is my tribe? Where's my family? And just the movies flatten that entirely, right?
Where do I belong?
Yeah, basically. That internal monologue. You don't have any of his conversations with his creator. So I think the movies, while being incredibly like visually compelling in this way that is just replicated again and again every year around Halloween, while it's compelling in that way, you lose all the depth of that character in those movie retellings.
Susan.
I agree. I think you lose a lot of the character of, you know, again, like you said, the middle of that story and the depth of the character, but you also turn it into, you really have turned, you know, the monster, you know, Frankenstein's the creation into the monster. That's how you see it, especially around Halloween. I think especially tying it into all the Halloween showings of it. You really just heighten that, the horror of it and like the, all the rest of the themes. And
we probably ought to emphasize, even in the, you know, the Alvin and the Chipmunks thing, technically Frankenstein is not the creature. That name, in, at least in the novel, is never applied to the creature. It's the only Frankenstein is Victor Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you are just joining us, we are talking about the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So the other part I want to get to, and in Destroyer, Victor, your creature has a much different look.
Yes.
It's a departure from the movie entirely. I mean, it looks more like in this probably a somewhat more than somewhat a disfigured basketball player who does a lot of yoga, and really really tall.
Yes.
And much more not the blocky thing. There are no bolts coming out of his head or any of that. How conscious a choice was that, you know, to break from what is the common perception of what the creature is supposed to look like?
Well, I definitely did not want in any way to have it look like the Bela Lugosi and everything since then. Creature, I was trying to get back to the book again, the original book, and what we talk about there. But when I was going over the sketches with the original artist, I sent him two images, and I said, I want you to put these two images together and find a way that to make the creature from this. And I sent him a picture of Michelangelo's statue of Moses and then Iggy Pop. I said, I want Iggy Pop Moses. And I think that's kind of what he –
and tall.
And it's kind of what he got when he came back with the image that became the creature. I was really like – man, that's better than I even would have dreamed.
Yeah.
But that I felt like those two, Moses and Iggy Pop, have exactly the energy I would want for my version of the creature.
We're talking about Frankenstein. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Doug has done and track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Doug writes, so Tim Power's book, The Stress of Her Regard, is an amazing work of historical fiction and should be read after everyone finishes Frankenstein. Have any of you read this? If so, please share your thoughts with the audience. Anyone?
I have to say it's a new book to me.
Yeah, I have not, and I just wrote it down.
Okay, Megan. Doug, we are taking notes here, even as we speak.
I'm always good for a book recommendation,
okay.
So I appreciate that.
And, Doug, if you have more thoughts on that and can flesh it out a little bit, a book description, we'd love to have that and have you join the conversation either through Twitter or just give us a call at 866-476-3881 and we can talk it through. What elements, Victor, with the book did you decide just would not translate well to a graphic novel?
Well, again, it was back to, I have to say, as much as I love the original, there are times where I do feel like, you know, maybe I wish the creature was a little more comfortable with silence. Mm-hmm. Like make that argument for a little while, then let's just take a break. And so I just thought, like, since mine is not a retelling, it's a continuation of the story. That's the way I imagined it. I figured by the time you get to the present day, the creature who is now living in the Antarctic and only dealing with wildlife, that he doesn't deal with humans at all, would have lost largely the ability to speak or had given it up. He hated humanity. He turned his back on humanity, so he might as well turn his back on the human language. And that allowed me also to not have a monster who talked all the time, but it would still make sense to me why that was the case.
Megan, what drew the Indiana Humanities? I'm going to slip up and call it the Indiana Humanities Council here. Because for so long that's what it went. What drew Indiana Humanities to Destroyer and to make it part of that discussion?
Yeah, well, just to mention it, we're lucky enough to have Victor come for a talk at the library this evening. So we'll be at the Central Branch at 6:30, and Victor will be talking about Destroyer in conversation with Dr. Leah Milne from UIndy. And it was Dr. Milne that actually called our attention to Victor's great adaptation. But I think, like, once you start, we were constantly looking for ways to make this 200-year-old book, which we think everybody should read, relevant to today. And obviously, Victor's adaptation is the most interesting one in my experience. And there are others, too, people that are picking up on the themes of Frankenstein and carrying those into contemporary settings. So I think we were really drawn to a new genre, new audiences that might be interested in a comic or a graphic novel. And we've had great response. Like, everybody that we recommend Victor's adaptation to is just thrilled and I think really intrigued by the way in which he talks about the politics of our time, but with this cast of Mary Shelley's original story over the whole thing.
What thing first spoke to you when you looked at it?
I am very drawn to the graphics. Around the office, we just love the covers. So we've just been really enjoying we deal a lot in just straight text on a page in most of our book discussions and things like that. So it was very nice to kind of break our traditional genres and experience something different. And I was also just very drawn to the way in which Victor has pulled in all of those contemporary conditions. So there's a moment where the creature is in a factory farm, and there's a moment when the creature crosses the border wall. And so seeing the Shelley's original, which I had spent so much time thinking about, walk into all of these conditions of our time, I think was really compelling for many reasons.
And Victor, why a graphic novel? Why did you decide that that was the medium that you wanted to use?
Well, I just really felt like exactly those images, like a me writing five pages explaining the monster walking up to, say, the border between Mexico and the U.S. and then describing the wall is one thing, but having just a panel or two where you just see the creature standing there and you see this half-built sort of ramshackle wall and you see on either side, you see some people trying to get through the border from the Mexico side, you see some people on the other side trying to keep them out. You look at that one image and you understand everything that those five pages would be trying to tell you. And so then I don't need to write five pages. I just have another panel and another. And there's an immediacy to that visual storytelling that struck me as really necessary for this story.
If you are just joining us, we are talking today about the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, which is marking its the 200th anniversary of its publication, first publication this year. Indiana Humanities is leading an effort to explore the themes and the dimensions in the book will be really accelerating this month. There are going to be like 200 events over the month of October. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Megan Teligman, Indiana Humanities Frankenstein Program Manager, author Victor Laval, and Susan Davis from the Indianapolis Public Library. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indiana Humanities campaign to lead the state through renewed exploration and appreciation of the novel Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, which is marking the 200th anniversary of its publication this year. My guests are Megan Teligman, Indiana Humanities Frankenstein Program Manager. I'd really love to see that on a business card, by the way.
I'll give you one when we leave. It's a pretty great card.
All right. Author Victor Laval and Susan Davis from the Indianapolis Public Library. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Paul has done and track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Paul writes, please note, Boris Karloff was the original monster in Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. Bela Lugosi did play the creature in later iterations, but the Karloff version is the one most remember.
Fair point. My mistake.
Yeah, well, and it's one of those things. Is there an adaptation that gets closest to the spirit of the book? Because most of the ones I've seen were what I used to think of as the Saturday late night specials, where you and your buddies would stay up just to scare yourselves, and you'd see this huge lumbering creature when you're about 9 or 10 years old, walking through terrorizing people. When it seemed like, okay, this thing moves so slow that, you know, anyone could run away from him. Is there anything that does get close to the spirit of it in film other than Destroyer?
Well, there is actually, there is a show, it's I guess it's finished now, Penny Dreadful.
Yes.
And they had a very nice version of the creature there. It was intelligent, also murderous. Mm-hmm. Not the lumbering creature at all. And it gained intelligence and language. And they made, I thought, one of the best adaptations of Frankenstein's creature in any media that I'd seen.
Susan, you know, and I may put you on the spot because you probably don't track everything, but is it a book people still seek out at the library on a fairly regular basis? Or?
Well, I know that we had, thanks to Indiana Humanities, free copies of the book that flew off the shelves. We were able to give away over 1,000 books, so close to 1,500 books even, and we just couldn't keep them in stock at the branches. As soon as we put them out, we started in mid-August, and we are on our last few copies of free copies that people just ate it up. They were so excited. They came in, got their free copy. So I think, yes, it still speaks to people at the library and wanting to own their own copy.
We are talking about the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Alex has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Alex, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I keep hearing you mention that Frankenstein, the Modern Prometheus, and I think readers would benefit from having an explicit connection made between the two and why that's important, and maybe even where we see modern stories of Prometheus in our current cultures.
Fair point. We made an allusion to it earlier, but we didn't explore it fully. Victor, thanks for the call, Alex.
Sure.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
certainly Shelley was tying it to what you'd mentioned very quickly, of course, like that the story of Prometheus is the god who stole fire from Zeus, stole fire from the gods and brought them to humanity.
A trickster, yeah.
Yes, and then also this isn't really that tied into the story, but he's the one who's also tied to a rock as punishment for that, and has his liver torn out every day by a hawk or something, by some giant bird. So that idea, but it is in there because it's the mix of like the creation of life, but also the suffering or the punishment for that creation. And what's interesting, back to that earlier point, is then you wonder, is Prometheus supposed to be the monster or victor? Because both of them suffer for the creation of life, and yet are also miracles, right? For all that Victor is whiny and all that stuff, it is still pretty miraculous. He did bring a dead body back to life, you know? So that tie, I think, is what Mary Shelley was trying to hearken to in the title, but also a way to, you know, point to the romantic ideals of the moment she and her and Percy and Byron were in, where they were looking to older civilizations for a sense of some like grand and romantic purpose and ideals. And all of that is being fed into her novel.
We haven't talked about this yet, but where did she get the idea? Go ahead, Megan.
She had a dream that kind of spurred some of this on. A pale student of unhallowed arts was the quote from her diary. She had this kind of vision and a dream of this scientist, the term didn't exist yet, but scientist kind of hunched over a table doing this monstrous thing. And you had spoken to Leah's class this morning a bit about her maybe more personal motivations, if you wanted to say something about that.
The aspects of her own family's, her losing a child, her mother having died in childbirth, those things were playing a big part in her, undoubtedly in her imagination. And then, of course, famously, there's also that she and Byron and Shelley and then a guy named Polidori all were off on basically like a weekend together telling ghost stories, and they all decided to come up with the best ghost story. It's also worth noting that Polidori wrote a story called The Vampire then too, but it didn't last in the same way that Mary's did. But she obviously came out with the best ghost story or scary story from that long weekend.
We probably ought to talk. We've alluded to what was going on in her life, obviously the death, but also just the tremendously complicated relationships. We tend to think of the past as a much simpler and settled time, and her life was about as messy as it comes.
For sure.
Victor?
She met and fell in love with Percy Shelley, who was already married and a father. The two of them essentially ran off together, and then she became pregnant with their first child who died. And then it was an enormous scandal. I believe her father, disowned her, was deeply shamed and embarrassed by it. Percy maybe seemed to even enjoy it, added to his bad boy image. Mm-hmm. And there's some conversation that can be had there about who really pays for these kind of scandals when it's a man or a woman. And Percy didn't come out, I think, being treated as badly as Mary did in all of this. But yes, I think reality television would have had some very good stars in that whole crew of the Shelleys and Byron if there had been televisions.
We have another tweet from a listener. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. This listener writes, are the people in the No Limits conversation familiar with Jill Lepore's article on Shelley in The New Yorker or Elizabeth Young's Black Frankenstein? And if so, did they think the issues raised in these works about race relevant to the conversation? I'll start with Megan on that.
Yeah, I read the Lepore piece a bit ago, but I'm more familiar with Black Frankenstein, though I haven't read the whole book. But I will say the story that sticks with me in that discussion is the comedian Dick Gregory, who had, I believe, a comedy album called Black Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And he kind of tells a story on that album about, like, he went to see the original Frankenstein and expected to be horrified or what have you, like his friends were. And he said, you know, I didn't have that feeling of horror. I didn't feel that terror. Instead, like, I identified with the creature because I realized what he was running from was the same thing that I was running from. Mm-hmm. So I think that is definitely echoed in Destroyer as well. And what I had mentioned earlier, too, about how we interact with people that are different from us and how we start to bridge those boundaries through empathy and what have you.
We have gotten a tweet from an English teacher. Mm-hmm. Again, you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. This teacher writes, "Hey at WFYI, so excited to hear your Frankenstein program today. My AP English class, and I just finished reading the book, thanks to Indiana Humanities, and loved it. Lots of themes that connect to big issues today. My students really connected to themes of gender and personal responsibility. Victor creates and then abandons the creature. They overwhelmingly see Victor as the villain. What theme stood out most to you, panelists?" Susan, I'll start with you.
I kind of echo that. I think that theme of what do we do as our next steps if we are looking at these scientific discoveries, and where do we go after that, and what are what about consent and issues having to do with accessibility even to those discoveries? There's a lot of implications from things that arise as we create and looking at those moving forward.
Megan.
Yeah, I think those themes of personal responsibility and gender are fascinating. I would have mm-hmm. loved to have been in on that conversation, especially with younger readers, high school students. I think the theme that really speaks to me that is maybe less talked about is the environmental mm-hmm. story and like where things take place in the novel. And that's largely from my interest and my background. But the fact that the creature and Victor have their meeting in the Alps, right, mm-hmm. on these snowy, sublime settings, and how this idea of the sublime, this kind of terror and awe, is also echoed in what happens to people when they confront the creature. Mm-hmm. There's some really interesting, Shelley's really playing around with that kind of how the setting echoes mm-hmm. the experiences of the book. And that's always just been maybe a smaller theme, but just really compelling to me.
Victor.
I'd agree with both of those, absolutely. One other thing that popped up to me that in the last read before I wrote Destroyer, it's a very small scene, but at a certain point, the creature says to Victor, "If you want to hate me, that's fine. You can hate me, but just make me a partner so that I can just live in the world." And Victor begins to make his partner for him. And then at a moment says, "But if I let him and his partner procreate, they will create a race of beings who will dominate us humans." And so as a result, he tears apart the bride and mm-hmm. throws the parts into the river, and the creature sees this, and this is when he becomes murderous, truly murderous. Mm-hmm. Everything's done. But I always think that's a very small moment, like a moment of insight into how or why people sometimes feel great fear about, say, new groups of people coming to an area, or the idea of like sharing power in some way, that the assumption that if other people come here and flourish, they will take things from me, they will punish me, they will kill me. And I always find that an interesting insight into a certain kind of mindset that is maybe about keeping all the resources of the world for oneself versus thinking there might be enough to share. Do you know, like, I just always find that an interesting like moment of insight into Victor, that he can't imagine that this creature might just desire to love something and be loved by something, he brings it back to himself and thinks, if I let them go off, they'll come back after me. And mm-hmm. I feel like it's an insight into he's got some guilt in there.
Now, with Destroyer, and again, I'm going to try to be I'll try to not reveal too much here, but there really are two kinds of creatures there. There's the original one, and then there's another one, and I don't want to give it. It's up to you. You can decide how much you want to give away since you wrote the thing. But it's also, with this other one, it is a slightly more hopeful take mm-hmm. on that. Well, more than slightly. A more hopeful take. Yeah, a more hopeful take on that. How did you decide to go there?
Well, so in my version, one of the things that I wanted to change was I wanted to have the mad scientist be a black woman mm-hmm. And have that black woman's son. I don't think it's much. This is shared pretty early. That black woman's son is killed and she brings him back to life. And so in that way, she's the new victor. But because I loved that son and he's even named after his name is Akai. And at the time when I was writing this, there was a man named Akai Gurley who was killed in New York City by a police officer. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to honor Akai, and I wanted to honor the idea of a person like Akai, of which there are many, who are lost to that kind of violence. And so as a result, I couldn't leave the book in a place of just sort of doom and loss, because my Dr. Frankenstein, Josephine Baker, loves her child. She's mm-hmm. not like Victor. She doesn't abandon him. In fact, she'll fight the world in order to protect him. And I thought that was an important distinction and a way to update the idea of the Frankenstein story.
Mm-hmm. Megan, Susan, obviously, if people have been listening to this and they want to continue the conversation with Victor this evening, how and where do they go about doing that?
Yeah, so you can visit the Indianapolis Central Library tonight. Doors will open at 6, and our program will start at 6:30. Victor will be in conversation with Dr. Leah Milne from the University of Indianapolis. And after, we'll have opportunities. You can purchase a copy of Destroyer, have it signed. You can also enjoy some beer, some horror-themed beer from Scarlet Lane Brewing Company, which is excellent. And, yeah, just have some time to talk about Frankenstein and think about contemporary iterations of this story.
And, again, there's no cost to the public to attend.
No.
It's open and all of that.
Yeah,
big weekend for you guys, obviously, because you get the Indiana Author Awards, too, right?
It is a big weekend, yes. We're going to be moving in from this wonderful talk tonight right to writing workshops and all sorts of fun explorations of all sorts of books on Saturday. So big weekend for the library.
Almost like a library, right?
I know.
I'd like to thank my guests, Megan Teligman, Victor Laval, and Susan Davis for what's been a lively conversation about a great book that is part of the Great American Read. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.